Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this study session of the Mesa City Council. We appreciate having you here. We have a very busy agenda this morning, so we're going to move right through those items. The first item will be to review the items on the agenda for our April 21st regular council meeting. Oh, yes, thank you. A reminder, Council Member Summers will be not with us today and will not be calling in. Thank you. Okay. Let everybody get caught up there. Tell me when you're ready. Okay. On page 2, we have items 1 through 3C. Items 3D through 3H. Items 3I through 4B. Items 4C through 4E. Item 4F, items that is, through 4H. Items 4I through 4K. Items 4L through 4N. Yes, Mr. Glover.
I have a question on 4M. So I don't know who's in charge of
that. That is the dollar limit increase for term contract, original equipment manufacturer.
M is in Mike.
Oh, Mike. Yeah, there was that one. Okay. This is out of fleet. Hi, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Pete. I just had a question. I'm like, what caused our estimate to be so far off on this case? Because it's almost twice the amount. And with the dollar increase that almost doubles initially, and it's not just for 1 year, but in continuing on, are we looking at other options and other alternatives for this one? And is there anything that we can do to save money, like get a new vendor or change tactics?
Councilmember Glover, Mayor, the Cummins Engine Company provides the engines for all the trucks in our solid waste fleet. There's one other competitor. It's much smaller, the Detroit Engine Company. We don't have a lot of experience with those units, and we haven't had them placed in a lot of the fleet before. As far as the amount of money that we're spending right now, it's about a $300,000 increase over what we've had in the past. And that's due mostly driven by the equipment coming in late, the solid waste equipment being delivered late. So we've actually extended the lives of these vehicles longer than we normally have. And we've taken a look at the spending trend so far, and it's actually going down right now. So will this continue? As we bring the new vehicles in and they're under warranty, actually it will drop the cost considerably. So really what's causing this spike is the fact that we've kept the trucks a little bit longer than we should have. A lot of that was driven by the fact that these are the new compressed natural gas trucks. This is the first time these trucks were put together by the manufacturer, and it's really delayed the delivery about 4 to 6 months.
Okay.
Good. Any other questions, sir? Thank you, sir. Appreciate the information. Next item is 4N. On that page, and then we go over to 4O through 4Q, and then items 4R through 4T, and then we have items 4U, and then item 5A, I believe we have some additional information. We invite up Ms. Tammy Albright, give us some insight.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. The packet that you have in front of you is slightly different than what you approved back in February before we went into the 30-day comment period, because we have received our final awards from HUD. And the good news is we did not receive the reduction that we thought. So using the methodology you approved, we went down the line and we added the funding to those folks that were next in line, keeping in mind the caps. We do have caps like in public service. We have also, just this week, received some public comments. We were still in the public comment period, I believe, till Monday. We received some comments, which I've put in front of you all, from West Mesa CDC, and also is the response from the city. We are required to submit the comments and our response with our annual action plan that you'll approve on Monday night.
Okay, questions for you from Mr. Cavanaugh?
Sure.
Thank you. With regard to the additional agencies funded under the formula, could you refresh our recollection of the ones who will now be being recommended for funding, the new ones?
Yes. In your packet, we have highlighted those in yellow. So let me just quickly go through that real quick. The last one that was receiving funding under the public service cap was Save the Family. They were receiving $9,000. That has gone up to $34,000. The ESG, when we were in front of you with the emergency solution grants, all of the money was falling in rapid rehousing, and you asked us to spread that out, put the 60% cap in the shelter and outreach, and then split the difference in rapid rehousing. So we did that, and we were able to add Central Arizona Shelter went from 16,000 to 41, and then the two rapid rehousing, which was Save the Family and a New Leaf, went up from New Leaf from 28 to 33, and Save the Family from 45 to 50. Now you will see a yellow block on Human Services. Part of your approval was to fund equal to last year in Human Services. Last year, Save the Family, we had split their 135,000 request. Part of it was in CDBG and part of it was in Human Services. Because they went up in CDBG, we reduced them in Human Services, and we were able to add, let's see where we are. We were able to add to Community Legal Services up to 29,000.
Thank you, Mayor.
As far as the comments go, they were basically a request for reconsideration for funding for co-compliance for West Mesa CDC. That particular application would fall under public service, which we were already capped at. We realize and agree that that is a very valuable service in our community. So what we had done back when you heard this in February is we moved those funds to the city's co-compliance program, which does comply with code for HUD under code enforcement. So the voluntary co-compliance program will be run there. We don't see a change in the service level. The activity would still be provided to the city through that program. I also believe the city manager is working on another component.
Thank you, So we were sensitive to the fact that all these proposals that were before you went through a competitive process. Presentations were made to committee members, and they made a recommendation on the ranking of their proposals. And then we applied the funding that was available based on that ranking. Because this one fell out or didn't quite make the cut, if you would have, based on funding, we still feel like, because co-compliance was a priority of the council, and we talked about it in the budget, we've moved the dollars related, we've funded into the city's co-compliance sufficient funds to provide for the temporary code officers that have been providing the service with West Mesa CDC. Based upon their feedback, I think their concern is they have a very specific program, kind of unique for their area, that they direct and provide outreach to. We understand that, and we're trying to help maintain that type of program as much as we can, even though the funding sources have changed. So one of the things that this might have left out by us being able to fund just the code officers in the code enforcement area is we recognize also that West Mesa CDC also provides services helping provide education and outreach to their community members about code issues and helping them become in compliance and being aware of their situation. So we recognize there's some value outside of the specific code officers themselves. So what we would propose, and I have not had a, this is very recent, so we haven't had a chance to talk to West Mesa CDC about this, but one of the ideas that I would propose, if you recall, in the proposed budget that we presented last week, we indicated, or we recommended to council, that we take the dollars that have been set aside, or that we've received from the service line warranty program, and set those aside to help supplement code enforcement. So what we would recommend is that the Department of Code Compliance, separate outside of the CDBG process, enter into a contract with West Mesa CDC with those funds to provide for the education outreach that's related to the services they provide today related to their code compliance program. So we're trying to help get the program back to where it is today. It's a little more bifurcated because of funding sources, but we think, we hope that that would help provide some supplemental funds to help them meet their needs in the way based on the way they provide the program today. So that's what we're attempting to do, or at least a recommendation that we could suggest.
Mr. Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to hear this. I think it's maybe a pathway to resolving the issue, because I know that members of the council in our own ranking of applications felt this is an important process not to eliminate. And I, from what I hear you saying in terms of what you're proposing, using the ABC funds doesn't come with the other entanglements that we have with the CDBG funds, which create those different limitations in terms of the CDB, in terms of the private staff versus public
staff. Mr. Kavanaugh, can I just, I'm not even recommending ABC funds.
Or, excuse me, I mean the utility.
Okay, thank line, you. Sorry. Just make sure, because I know that's another topic.
Yeah, no, the utility line warranty.
Yeah, exactly.
Funds. Yeah, perfect. Exactly. They don't have the restrictions.
Correct. That is correct.
The issues that you have with the other sources
correct.
Of funds.
That is correct.
So that might provide a pathway.
That's what we believe. That's what I'm hoping for.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Brady.
Okay. Good. So we have. So we feel like we're getting some resolution.
I guess we're proposing that if council get a general agreement, we need to go and obviously sit down with West Mesa CDC and propose that as an alternative.
Mr. Ritsons.
Yeah, just a quick comment that that's been enormously successful at decreasing the amount of code. I mean, that education piece, I think, has been our missing link for a long time, and it's kind of adding the carrot to our stick approach. And it's hopefully at some point we'll be able to roll it out across the entire city, but it's kind of been developing, and we're working out the kinks in West Side neighborhoods. And I've really admired the work that West Mesa CDC has done on this, so I appreciate the creative thinking on how to keep it preserved. So thank you.
Right. And I'd like to echo that, too. Many times I've been out on East Main and others, and I said, why don't we have this out here, and how do we get this across the city? So there's some real positives going down that road. So thank you.
All right.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Albright. Okay, next items on the consent agenda would be 5B through 5D. 5E through 5J. 6A. Yes, I'm 6I. Okay. How do we get there? Okay. I'm sorry, which item did you want? 6I. Okay, so we have 6A through 6D, and then our next page would be 6E through 6H, and then 6I. Mr. Luna.
Mr. Wesley, maybe you could speak to 6I and tell me about the process. How did this happen?
Okay. Mayor, council members, item 6I is a request for property at 602 South Edgewater Drive for rezoning to add the historic landmark overlay district at this location. It's kind of interesting when this came to our attention. This property was originally built by Lauren Green, who was the father on the Bonanza series, and he built it just like the Ponderosa Ranch used in that series. Mm-hmm. And so you go out and look at it today, you think you're on the set for the Bonanza series. The current property owner recognized the value of that house and its role both in history there and as one of the first houses built in the subdivision, and apparently Mr. Green was supportive of the development in the valley and starting some of the development in the area. So it kind of has both of those connections. So they've requested this historic overlay to help maintain this house long-term, keeping that historic character.
Neat. Thank you.
Yeah, never knew. Yeah. That's kind of neat.
Sorry. Neither did I.
There's
there's a real cool picture on it. Because it's Bonanza.
Oh, wonderful.
The Ponderosa.
Yeah, great. Okay, 6J. Looks like all the way down to 8B. And then that's it. Thank you. So that should cover our consent agenda. I think we've covered everything so far there. Next item on our study session agenda will be to hear a presentation, discussion, and direction on the F for 14-15 utility rate adjustments on 2A. Welcome.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. This morning, what we'd like to talk to you about is our enterprise fund side. Last Thursday, we came and talked to you about our general fund budget. This week is really we're talking about the other side, the other unrestricted side, which is our enterprise fund forecast, and then also our adjustment recommendations for the utility rates themselves. Just as a reminder, each utility within in the enterprise fund are multiple enterprises within that fund, and each one is run separately and managed separately. They all, though, do join in one particular fund, so they use one reserve balance to go across all of the different enterprises. They follow the same reserve balance that our general fund reserve balance does, which is we try to maintain an 8 to 10% over the forecast period. So again, we're not looking at 1 year at a time. We're looking at what our reserve balance looks like in the next 3 years, 5 years, 8 years type of a thing that we manage to. In the enterprise fund, the reserve balance is also used to smooth the rates because the main contributor to the revenues on this side is utility rates. Over time, when we have peaks in expenditures in any particular year, we also don't want the utility rates to peak in that particular year to our customers. And so we use a smoothing mechanism where we actually smooth the rates over time to get to the achieved revenues we need for that particular year. And our reserve balance allows us to do that, gives us some rate stabilization for our customers. As we have seen in the capital improvement presentations, our capital investment is needed and is to strategically position the city for future economic growth. We talked about that in our capital improvement program overviews, where we have a water plant that we're in need of building within the next couple of years, as well as a wastewater plant. Those particular costs, meaning the debt service related to that financing of those plants, has been included in the forecast. The other item in the enterprise fund is subject to the same inflationary pressures that our general fund is. So when we have increase in the cost of fuel and parts, for example, what was on your agenda item this morning regarding solid waste, they are in our enterprise fund. So as the increased inflationary costs of those types of things increase, so does the whole expenses for the enterprise fund in total. One of the things that we've talked about before is that transition to the compressed natural gas for our solid waste vehicles. So we're hoping as we're able to transition from the diesel to the CNG that we'll be able to accommodate some of those costs and maybe bring some of those pressures down on operating those vehicles. Other items that we're just going to touch on real briefly because we touched on these last week. Again, anything that involves the general fund also involves the enterprise fund. So when there's changes in the medical costs, pension costs, workers' compensation, those types of things, they all affect the enterprise fund as well as the general fund. These are just some examples to remind you of the examples of water projects that we have already been completed. These projects, the debt service for these projects is current debt service that's included in the forecast. So these projects have been completed, and we're currently paying the debt service on these, and that comes through the rates. A reminder of the upcoming projects that are scheduled in the current capital improvement program. The anticipated debt service for these projects has also been included in the forecast so that we can smooth the rates in order to meet those obligations. One of the things that we're looking at is when we look at our enterprise fund, we are seeing that we have a debt service increase coming up in a couple of years, and that's one of the things that we are planning for. It's coming up in the 17-18 and 18-19 fiscal years. So we're seeing our increased debt service go up about $12.1 million over that particular time frame. Our Signal Butte operating plan is the one that we discuss as the new water plant that's needed for the infrastructure in Southeast Mesa. And the operations and maintenance of that plant, when it does open, has also been included in the forecast. As we look at how we structure our rates and how we achieve the revenue in order to cover the cost of these particular operations, we look at there's in the water and wastewater sides, there are the service charges as well as the variable rates. The service charge is a more stable revenue generator for the operations of the utilities versus the variation in the demand side. When we look at this chart here, you can see that since 2004-05, if you look at the red line, This is the consumption of the water, the actual consumption of the water within the city of Mesa. What you see on the blue line, the number of accounts have actually increased over that time. So the number of accounts is actually the more stable predictor going through the city on where we, when we're doing our rates between our service charges and our variable charges. One of the things that helps us to maintain rate stabilization is to put to make sure that we are anticipating those various accounts and demands for service in the future, and to make sure that we're structuring our rates to make sure that we can address those fixed or the costs that are there we have to pay every year, like debt service, those types of things, to pay for the infrastructure that we've put in. One of the things that we have, our current policy, for our current direction from the council, has been for the city to move their water, the water and wastewater, toward more of a 40% recovery of expenditures on the fixed or the service charge portion of the rate. We're not quite there at the 40%, but those are the direction that we're going under. We're currently at 33%. If we were to look at any adjustments coming forward, if we were to spread those adjustments equally between the service charge and the variable portion, we would remain at 33%. However, if we start to move a little bit of that toward the service charge, we'll get more toward our the goal of trying to reach the 40% of expenditures.
Question here, Mr. Richens.
One of the things we talked about in committee, and appreciated the time that you've taken to kind of walk me through some of this. Another way to kind of think of that service charge is pipes, plants,
pumps,
debt,
meters.
Yeah, the stuff. So all the stuff that delivers the wet stuff.
Correct.
To the customer. And, you know, I've had many an argument with temporary residents that are here for 6 months, a year, basically, that wish their water could be turned off, you know, and not have to pay anything. And when we point out that if they want the pipes there, continue delivering water when they come back, that we have to pay for that infrastructure. It's been, it's a good educational piece. And so we talked a lot about rate structure. Do we cover our service charge or an infrastructure charge with something that is comprehensive, that covers all of the pipes and plants and debt? And then do we have another charge just for the wet stuff, for the water that they use? And so that way you can kind of separate that out for at least the part-time residents. And so we've actually had additional conversations about that since to kind of understand that. And pulling all that apart is a lot more complicated than it seems, because you have 89% of our customers
are residential.
And then you have all of your commercial customers, and they have various meter sizes and everything. And so one of the things I'd like to propose we do for this year is, I think that we're on the right track as far as where we're moving with this, mm-hmm. but I think we need to do a better, or we need, I know that the utility department has done a rate study. They've done a nice job with that. A lot of work around how their costs are structured. So maybe this fiscal year, I'd like to suggest that we take that just a little bit further, so we could really understand how we could structure these charges in a way that we could bring some sustainability to our system as far as infrastructure. So people have a clear understanding that pipes and plants and debt associated with delivering water to their houses are that service charge, that infrastructure charge. I prefer to call it infrastructure charge than service charge. And then we could start really having conversation about conservation when it comes to the water, the wet stuff use. And those, you know, those prices are really out of our control. CAP is going to charge us another $1 million this year for CAP water. And, you know, maybe we also need to have a conversation about people that live in SRP service territory absorbing costs associated with that, and then people who live in CAP territory absorb charges with that. You know, so depending on where you live, you know, people that live in Flagstaff pay more for water, and they know it when they move there because it's hard to get water there. So just kind of, hopefully over the course of this year, we could figure out how to really study that, mm-hmm. and find a way that we can bring some real solid sustainability to our infrastructure side of that, so we don't have to worry as much. And then the water is just going to be reflective of the commodity. And so if I decide if water rates or water costs are going up, I can use less water and I can save myself money that way. So, you know, and I got to give a lot of credit to our water department and Dan and his predecessors for the work that they've done to really make sure our system is efficient and up to date, and they're staying ahead of anticipated repairs. So if we could, you know, do something like that this year. I think it'll get us closer next year to a rate structure that doesn't feel like a huge increase, but also reflects, hey, you know, water is going to do nothing but get more expensive in an arid state like Arizona, and we need to start recognizing that and put a structure in place that'll protect our system and our customers in the future. That's my speech. Thanks.
But thank you, and that's I appreciate that direction, and we can follow through. And I think we've got a good groundwork. We need to get in front of the council a few times. It's a fairly complex model. Mm-hmm. Today, we're giving you a very simplified model. As you talked about it, we really separate out the capital costs where we can identify plants and pipes and the capital costs specifically associated with that and separate that from all the other costs, and that's how we determine it. But there are definitely maybe more granular ways of looking at that based on consumption and meter size. We can do that. But council, we always want to make sure we understand is what we're proposing then in the rate increases is we are proposing to adjust that fixed cost related to capital just as but it still gets us, it's still related to the same percentage increase of utilities, but we do feel like it's important to continue to maintain growth in that cost that's related to pipes and fixtures. Now that applies to everyone, so it becomes the minimum amount that anyone would pay to have an account with the city. So that's just something to keep in mind. But it does begin to represent truly the cost it takes for us just to bring a pipe to your house. Whether or not you turn the water on or not, that's the cost to be in a position so that whenever you turn that faucet, the water will come, or when you need to flush the toilet or have water drain out, it'll go through the sewer system. So that's kind of this. We're still moving forward to the same structure that we've been talking about in the past. Okay.
And this is really just shows you this sort of a simplified version of what we're recommending here with the blue dotted line. That shows our recommendation. The recommendation is to put more of the adjustment on the service charge versus the variable charge in order to achieve the goals of the city of going more toward that stability of the rate. The actual recommendation is a service charge increase of $3 per month with a 3.5% increase on all the other variable rate components. For an average utility water customer, that would go from a $39.69 to $43.32 would be the difference in those in the adjustment. We also want to bring to your attention that there is a new water rate that is being recommended to include, and this is our large turf facility untreated water service. These are new customers coming into the system whose ability or access to the water they had previously will be going away. They will be joining and getting water from the city of Mesa, and so we need a new rate in order to accommodate these customers. On our wastewater utility has the same things. Again, we're just reminding you of the projects that have already been completed are included in the debt service that are in the forecast here, as well as projects that have been approved in the last bond election and will be coming or being proposed in the next bond election for November, and that anticipated debt service has also been included in the forecast. In the wastewater utility, the debt service increase between now and 18-19 is currently anticipated at about a $14.8 million, and does include the coming on or the expansion of the Greenfield Water Reclamation Plant, as well as the operating of that plant once that plant comes online to begin in fiscal year 17-18. The recommendation for the wastewater is a service charge increase of $2 with a 4% increase on all of the other rate components, again in the same alignment of moving toward the service charge for rate stabilization.
So, Mayor and Council, just before we kind of finish up water and wastewater, so our kind of concept, if you would, that we're proposing to the Council is to move forward with significant improvements in the capital side to anticipate, position ourselves for significant growth in the city, specifically in the Southeast Mesa area. And so you have a pretty, that's why you see a significant opportunity, and we've talked about that in our capital plan. These proposed rates begin to continue to position us not only to cover the existing debt, but also position ourselves to pay for those costs in the future. However, in our rate assumptions, we don't assume a significant amount of growth in the number of accounts or accounts for consumption. So that allows for us to do two things. One, by continuing to be aggressive to meet what we hope will be the need for the capital in the future by putting those infrastructures in, putting the infrastructure in place is important. And so there's significant cost to that. But we've also been very conservative about the assumption of what might actually happen. The point is, if things do happen sooner than our model suggests, which is a pretty modest growth rate in our model, then the future cost to pay for debt will actually be mitigated somewhat because of the additional growth. So we've gotten, we think we have a pretty significant model that could meet growth in the near future, but we have a very conservative assumption about how fast that growth will actually take place. So if the growth takes place faster than we expect, that'll help to offset some of that cost sooner in our model than we expect. So that's kind of our philosophy. And so initially it can look very dramatic as far as the rate increases, but we're also hoping that our conservative assumptions of growth will be outpaced by the reality, and then we'll be able to come back hopefully and maybe see some of those rates possibly if growth exceeds our expectations to mitigate some of that cost in the future.
Maybe we'll be happily surprised.
That's what we're hoping for. Yeah. But we just didn't want to be in a position where we have to turn away development because we weren't in a position with the infrastructure. So that's kind of been that is our philosophy with specifically with the water and wastewater going forward.
Excellent. Understand. Good.
On the electric side, electric and gas are a little bit different than water and wastewater in the fact that we actually pass the commodity cost directly through to the customer. So it's not part of the rate component for coverage of costs. It's actually passed through to the customer on both of those. So when we talk about any type of adjustments to the rates, we are not talking about that particular component that's adjusted based on the cost to the city. Equipment and technology to support the plan, the optimization, and the plan maintenance are included in the forecast. So we're always looking to, again, maintain and be efficient with the resources that we have. The proposed service charge increase on the electric will still be below the SRP. Again, with electric and gas, it's a little bit different because we do have other entities within the area that provide the same type of a service to different areas. We do a comparison with SRP when we look at electric. We do a comparison with Southwest Gas when we look at the gas rates. After the proposed adjustment, we will still be $10.50 lower on our service charge than in the SRP areas. For residential, I should say. We're looking at residential on these. The service charge for residential customers, it'll be adjusted $5.71 for a total of $6.50 per month for electric. The average customer will go from $45.19 to a $45.98, again, not including the commodity pass-through for those. On the electric side, this is the first proposed adjustment since fiscal year 03-04 for the residential customers. Gas is the same way. We have a commodity cost for our natural gas customers. The commodity is passed through directly through their bill. The debt service is going to go up about $3 million anticipated between now and 18-19 for our gas customers, or for our gas service, I should say. The recommended increase is $1.14 per month, which would bring us to $12.28 per month for our customers. And again, does not include the pass-through cost for that. On the solid waste side, we have talked about how the solid waste is feeling the pressure, inflationary pressures from the vehicle usage of theirs. They are out there doing that, as well as their landfill costs are increasing in 14-15. Again, we've talked about the compressed natural gas and how we'll be converting their fleet and hoping to kind of mitigate some of those expenses in the future coming in. We're also looking at new landfill and recycling contracts that are being negotiated, and so we hope to see some savings from those contracts in the forthcoming years as well. One of the things that is included in this particular forecast for 14-15 and the budget for 14-15 is a new software package for them. Their existing software package is no longer supported by the vendor, and so we are making an investment in that area to allow them better mapping of their routes and location of their vehicles and so forth. So again, utilizing the efficient use of our resources. Solid waste recommendation is that the 90-gallon barrel is recommended to increase from $23.81 to $25.45. We also have a recommendation for the Mesa Green and Clean fee to be adjusted from 56 cents to 65 cents. This offsets some of those particular costs in those programs. An average residential customer increases by $1.73. The recommendation is also, this is on the residential side, there's also a recommendation on the commercial side to increase an average of 5.9% and the roll-off by an average of 2.9. And as a reminder, on the residential side, we are the only provider for residential solid waste service in the city of Mesa. However, on the commercial side, we compete with every other solid waste provider out there for our commercial accounts. So as we're looking at our commercial accounts, we're always making sure that we are competitive within the market to obtain those customers. Now, this is a summary of the anticipated rate adjustments over the next 3 years. Again, this really kind of outlines how we try to smooth the rates over time for our customers so that there isn't any type of a rate shock in any particular year. Again, if you recall, it was in the fiscal year 17-18 and 18-19 where we're going to see those increases in debt service. So this is really a three-year plan to get our revenues in alignment with those particular operating expenses that will come on board in those years. One of the things we do is we do an average homeowners, we used to call it average homeowners survey. We've changed that name to average homeowners comparison because we're not really out there surveying the homeowners. It's really a survey of other communities and what their rates are and what the costs are to their citizens versus the cost to our citizens. We do that comparison. One of the things that we compare is our water, wastewater, and solid waste rates because not all municipalities, they don't own their electric and their gas, and those are outside agencies. So when we look at that overall, we're looking at a $7.79 per month increase to the average City of Mesa residential customer. Again, we talked about the enterprise fund, just like the general fund, has financial policies that we adhere to. This does affect our bond rating that we receive for our bonds, which affects the interest that we pay on those, which affects our debt service, which affects our forecast, which affects our rates. Mm-hmm. So it's all tied together. So when we're looking at our forecast out, we're looking out again, we're trying to stay between 8-10% on our reserve balance. And if you look out as we go into 16-17, while in 14-15 we're anticipating 12.9% is where we would end, if you look over the next couple of years, you see that does continue to drop. That means we are using reserve balances to offset the rate stabilization, to keep our rates smoothed. We're actually using the reserve balance. And that's one of the reasons for having the reserve balance at certain levels is to allow us to smooth rates over time. So that you see once we get to the 16-17, we won't have a rate hike or a rate shock at that point. Today we're looking for feedback and direction from council on our adjustments. If the council agrees with the adjustments I've set forth today, we will be coming back and introducing these on May 5th for ordinances and adoption on May 19th. The utility rate adjustments would go into effect on July 1st.
Okay. Council, any feedback? Okay. Then I think that Mr. Brady, anything to add with that?
No, thank you. We've been discussing the capital programs and all that, so that we appreciate your feedback. We went to the committee. We've had that opportunity. So we'll just move forward and be bringing these to the council. And then soon after the adoption of the budget, we'll be coming back to council just another briefing and begin discussing specifics about the proposed utility bond election for November, because we'll need to make a decision this summer, early summer, about making that, putting that on the election November and the dollar amounts that we'll have to provide for. So, thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Appreciate it. Item 2B, hear presentation, discuss, and provide direction on proposed fees and charges for the following, and it we'll let them run through those, please.
Yes. So this is us as well.
Yes.
So fees and charges, one of the things that we also bring to council each year is we want to come back and review all of the various fees and charges throughout the city to make sure that we're in alignment with our operating costs of providing those particular services. So what we're going to do is I have a list of departments here. All of these departments have recommended some type of an adjustment to one of the fees. and we're going to kind of go through each department. So if you have questions, those department representatives are here if you have more further questions on those. And we'll just kind of hit the highlights and let me know if you have questions, and we'll stop and discuss. In our arts and cultural department, many of their fees are based on ranges. So the council actually approves a range and then gives that capacity to the directors to actually price their services within the market rate of what's going there. So some of these are just changes, recommended changes to the ranges, and other ones are actually establishing ranges for those areas that did not currently have ranges on those as well. The backup has all of the detailed information. They have a lot of different types of services and fees that they charge there. The same thing on their arts and culture for their Mesa Arts Center is the same thing on Performing Live. It's again giving them some range capacity so that they can negotiate when they're doing rentals and events and those types of things. So it's changing some adjustments to those ranges. In business services, this is a recommendation for a new fee. This fee is a credit check services fee, which actually will allow residents who are coming in for utility services for the first time, who would normally have to leave a deposit for those particular utilities, would allow them to pay a $2 fee so that the city can do a credit check and allow them to bypass or not have to do the deposit for those utilities.
Question, Mr. Cavanaugh.
Just comment, I appreciate this recommendation because I think everyone in the council has gotten calls and emails and complaints about people who have been longtime customers and other communities or prior Mesa customers, and I think this is a great option to alleviate those concerns.
Thank you. On the planning and development area, this is an adjustment to a commercial request for request for information, and it's just really to align it better with the actual cost of providing that service of retrieving records for a commercial purpose, going to an hourly fee rather than going to a per item type fee. Another one in environmental sustainability. This is our environmental compliance fee. If you may recall, the council current direction is that we cover all of our environmental compliance mandates. Those are both federal and state mandates through this particular funding mechanism, which is the fee to cover these unfunded mandates. These are things like stormwater retention and collection. It's our air quality, asbestos, lead paint, those types of things that we're required to do here within the city of Mesa. These are based on, again, one of the things that we're seeing that we've talked about last week when we talked about our Parks and Recreation Department, one of the inflationary or the large inflationary costs we're looking at in 14-15 is the cost to maintain the parks. Well, we usually say parks, but the reality is that the majority of those are basins. They're actually stormwater basins that we're maintaining. So as the cost to maintain the parks increases, so does the cost to maintain the basins. So we did recall that some of that is funded by the general fund. The basins are actually funded by the environmental compliance fee. That would be the result is a need for an increase in this fee of $1.94. This fee is a flat fee that is assessed during on the utility bills. It doesn't matter how many utilities a particular customer has with us, they receive one fee as long as they have one utility with us. Falcon Field Airport is just recommending the elimination of a fee that they are no longer in need of. Library services have some small increase to a variety of fees that they have within their facilities. So these are things like renting of different things, fees for not picking up the things that are on hold, purchasing of earbuds, that type of a thing. So there's a miscellaneous amount of fees and small adjustments on those. Solid waste management. This is the solid waste residential development tax. This is the cost that is assessed to a new customer. So this is a customer who is an area who has not had service to a particular home before. So this is a new service. This actually reimburses the city for the cost of the barrels as well as the delivery of those. The cost has gone up over time, and so we are adjusting the fee to bring it up from $185 to $197 in order to recover those costs. Transportation is our last one. This is an update for their deposits that they charge to contractors when they borrow our city-owned traffic signal equipment, and it's just to bring it up to the cost of that equipment. Are there any questions on any of those areas?
Any questions? Nope. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you very much. That covered a lot of area. Okay, our next item is going to be 2C here, presentation discuss the highlights of development and sustainability. If we could take just a moment, we have a blue card from a gentleman that wants to come up and speak to this. This is a little different than what we've done in the past, and I think we're going to work on tweaking how we have citizen involvement or information. So we'd like to invite up, what is his name, Tim Laskowski. Come up, sir. You have, if you'll tell us your address, information, you have 3 minutes. Come right up to the mic here. Give us a little bit of feedback, and then we'll go right into that presentation.
Good morning. My name is Tim Laskowski. I live at 1332 East Hopi Circle in Mesa.
Tim, you can sit down there. That's
Thank
all,
you, sir.
All good.
Mm-hmm. I came here today to speak about the serious problem we have in District 4 regarding the lack of code enforcement. As you know, the city has identified District 4 as being hard hit in the, when we had the downturn in the economy and the high level of foreclosures. Currently, we have a lot of homes in the area that aren't being maintained. Many of them are either investor-owned, or some of them are privately owned. But the current system the city has is reactive rather than proactive for our district, and it's not working. People don't want to call in because they want a name and a phone number, and their fear that there'll be problems with the neighbor. They may complain. And when we did have proactive enforcement in our area, it looked so much better, and of course, it helps maintain the property values. And we live in a nice area, but unfortunately, with the blight that we're seeing now because of the lack of code enforcement, it's starting to look pretty run down. So, I've worked with my council member Glover for quite some time trying to get the code enforcement back. He's very much aware of the problem that we have in our district, and pretty much here to beg, plead with the city to return, the funding for and get active code enforcement back in our area so we can, restore it back to the level it was prior to this.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome up our Development and Sustainability Department, Ms. Solanka.
Morning, Mayor.
Nice to see you. Thank
and
you.
Council members, I have with me Pamela Alexander. She's our senior fiscal analyst. I have a couple of the deputies here in various areas. Most of them, however, are down at the ITD area. We've got vendor demonstrations today on our new Tidemark or our permitting system update. So we've got people split around. So I will do my best to answer questions. I will address the code issue when we get there, but I'll start with the overall department. To refresh your memories, we've got a fairly eclectic department. It includes John Wesley's planning area, which is everything from annexations to final zoning, rezoning, site plan, that kind of thing, and historic preservation. Okay, and the permitting services, that includes the logging in of development plans, logging them out. In that area, we also, one of the things we were able to bring back over the last couple of years are development information specialists. They're able to answer more complex questions than a regular permit tech is, and they keep a lot of the simple stuff out of the more senior plans examiner's queue. So that's been very helpful. We've been able to work that in. We have the development planning section. Beth Huser-Nellis runs that. That's primarily being a central point of contact with the other departments on infrastructure issues. We work with water resources for both water and wastewater, transportation, and then also electric and gas when it's the development projects are in those areas. The building plan review area, and that's all of the vertical construction. That's managed by Steve Heather, who's also our building official. One of the things that we've added into that area that you've requested us over the last couple of years, we have a part-time over-the-counter building plans examiner, and the idea that council really pushed us on was to take away the small mom-and-pop kinds of development. That's been an extremely successful program. We've recently been able to hire a part-time permanent person, and the idea is that somebody can come in who's not a sophisticated developer. That individual can work with them on plan review, and they can actually go out to the house, so they can be both a plans examiner and an inspector to try to make it, as number one, as quick as possible and as easy as possible for someone who doesn't necessarily have an architect and an engineer on board. We also have building inspections. We're going to talk a little bit about that. That's under Laura Heineman, and she's also down at ITD looking at vendor demonstrations. Laura's also responsible for code compliance, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more, and then also the building inspections and the certificates of occupancy for completed new development. The other area that we have is environmental and sustainability, and that's managed by Scott Boucher. So to talk a little bit, and I know that we've mentioned this to you over the last year and a half, the amount of construction and new development in the city of Mesa has increased dramatically over the last couple of years. And I think we've had some good discussions on what the stressors are in my department with the very lean staff that we have. What I wanted to show you here, I love this graph. What this shows you, this is from March 13th to 14th, and if you took it back a few years before that, you'd see that this is up here and prior years were down here. But just to show you, the green is the total valuation of all of the construction. You'll see the big blip in the middle there. That was primarily residential construction, and a lot of that was coming in from Eastmark as the new residential areas were going out there. Plus, there's an awful lot of additional residential development across the cities and some of the larger in the city and larger areas. The blue is commercial, and it took a long time for the commercial to start coming up, but we're seeing a bit of a trend there that commercial's coming up. And then the purple up on the top of the line is our combined revenue from all sources. One of the things that we've seen this past year is a significant increase in the actual received revenue compared to what was projected. Everything that we've been working with, Office of Management and Budget and the forecasters, is that the same level is not going to continue through the next year. So our projections for growth increase next year are somewhere between about 1 and 2.5%. We continue to be extremely conservative on what may or may not happen with the economy. A lot of the excess revenue, or the revenues above projections, we've actually used to continue to employ temporary services, both in plan review, permitting, and inspections to meet that demand. So that's been almost a daily juggling act of when we bring temp workers in. I'll talk in just a couple of minutes about the additional full-time equivalent positions that we were able to add. This slide also indicates that we're definitely seeing a trend in the increase in development activity over the last year. Again, we expect that the curve or the incline of that's probably going to level out a little bit over the next year. We're hoping it continues to increase at this rate. One of the things I wanted to talk about specifically was building inspectors. What we've got here, this, and I know the graph is hard to read, but you can look at the trend lines here. This is the number of inspection stops conducted per inspector per month. We're currently up almost to 18 inspection stops, and each inspection stop can be anywhere from 1 to 5 or 6 inspections. Because of the increase in development and activity, we've had to do two things over this last year that I wanted you to be aware of. One of the things, at the bottom of the recession, we said that the building inspectors would also do code enforcement and they would also do environmental inspections. With the development activity, they simply have not had the ability to do that. So we've added an environmental technician that is responsible primarily for stormwater, air quality, and hazardous materials. And the code enforcement piece of what building inspections done is, we originally agreed that they would do it. They are no longer doing it. They are simply complying with our 24-hour commitment to the development community to get that out there and get the inspections done. Just to review the positions that we've been able to add this past year because of that consistent growth. We have three plans examiners. Two of those were actually dedicated to Apple. They still are continuing to work with Apple as they move forward out there. We have two full-time planners, and that's just because of the tremendous workload that's come in through planning as far as subdivisions that need to get worked through the final stages on the entitlements. We've added a civil fire plans examiner and a fire plans examiner. Again, the civil is primarily the infrastructure, and then the fire is working with the fire department to ensure compliance with the fire codes. We've also added an admin support assistant, and that's primarily to help processing and planning to make sure that we meet the time requirements that the development industry expects from us. One GIS specialist, we used to have a lot more than that, but the world lives by maps these days, and one of the things we really want to do is increase the transparency. If a developer is looking at going in and seeing a particular parcel, what's the zoning on it, what are the previous cases, if there's a development agreement on it, so that it really increases the usability of the city electronic system for our community. Plus my staff, makes it an awful lot easier. And as I also said, we have one part-time over-the-counter plans examiner. That's been a tremendously popular program, and at some point we'd love to convert that back to a full-time position because of the demand. I love to show this picture. We're currently based on a hard copy system. We're at a point that the development industry is really tired of doing this. It costs them a lot of money to print plans. We don't currently have the ability to accept plans or review them electronically, and that's part of the reason that we're upgrading the permitting system. The other thing that we're doing here, this is actually our plan room and then the overflow plan room. Council Member Luna was sort of appalled what our break room looks like now. It's filled with plan sets. But we started a project about 3 years ago using temp workers, just trying to band-aid a scanning program together. We're valiantly trying to get all of these old hard copy plans scan so that they're available to the development community, to mom and dad, and to our staff electronically rather than having to go down and try to find these plans. Let me see. An update on the department permitting system. That's what we're working on right now. We're very excited about this. Our current permitting system, the Tidemark system, is over 10 years old. It's very outdated technology. It is not user-friendly, and it's not very transparent to the public. So last year, we were given a one-time allocation to upgrade that system. We've gone through an RFP process. We've had proposals in. This week and next week, we're actually looking at the vendor demonstrations. Our hope is that we will have that new system fully implemented by the end of 2015, by June of 15. So we've been working on that valiantly to try to make that happen. It's funded by the technology fee. We actually established a technology several years ago at the guidance of the city manager, realizing that technology has to be replaced. You know, I think the standard in the industry is probably at least 3 years. We're currently looking at 10-year replacement, but this will allow much more transparency to the development community, to our residents. A lot of cities have implemented this kind of system. Their experience has been the increase in productivity for plans examiners is somewhere between 25% and 50%. You can have a plans examiner sitting here in Mesa with an interactive monitor talking to an engineer back in New Jersey. The idea is they'd never have to come down. They can just sit and get plans electronically, work on them, get the final plans done. So we're very excited about making that happen. I want to talk a little bit about code compliance. Councilmember Glover, one of the questions you asked me yesterday, did we have any additional code officers in this year's budget? We do not. So we currently have 7 code officers. 2 of them are in the CDBG area. And what we're showing on this map, the crosshatched areas that are a little bit hard to see here, but it's primarily West Mesa and then kind of running along through Main Street. We currently have 2 CDBG areas working in that area. The colored areas are where the rest of our inspectors work. If you look in the southeast area, That's more than 42 square miles that one individual has to work there. In District 4, there are some CDBG areas, but except for the CDBG areas, with the gentleman who just spoke is correct. We really only have the resources to respond on a complaint basis. Just a little bit off track, but the CDBG, West Mesa CDBG collaborative effort we've worked on over the last 3 years, I think has been very, very productive. We've been trying to work with that group. They go out and do the outreach, the neighborhood discussions, and then it's only when they get to the point of having a significant issue where they can't get voluntary compliance that they send it over to the city. So I just wanted to say that that's been a very successful program, and we'd love to see that continue.
Okay, Mr. Glover and then Mr. Cavanaugh.
Well, Dennis can go first.
I'm probably going to say what you're going to say. I know that I think one of the strong priorities of our council is to add additional compliance officers. And, you know, the fact that there aren't any in this up-year, in this coming budget, is discouraging. And because, again, the complaints we get on the council are continuous. The code complaints we file as council members are increasing. And I think there's an expectation in the community. Community knows that things are getting better and the city is doing better. We're not in the headlines with giant deficits. And there is an expectation among our neighborhoods that that we move back towards a proactive code compliance situation. And we're not going to be able to do that without positions. But I think, you know, I think there's going to be council support for in this area. So I just wanted to make that clear. I know Councilmember Glover has really been the leader on this for the council, so I'll defer to him.
Yeah. No, I'll just echo what Councilmember Cavanaugh. I was under the impression that we were going to be adding at least 2 co-compliance officers to this budget season. And so I'm very disappointed in that, and I will lead the charge that we can try to at least get 2 and then build from there. And I understand that we don't want it to be a burden on the general fund, but maybe we can look for other sources of funding. And I think that we can be very innovative in this city and find those funding sources so that can be sustainable for the future as well. But I know that that will be one of those budget discussions that I will be pushing for to try to get at least 2 more this year and then try to add more officers each and every year to have it what it was once and then try to make it even better than that.
We'll certainly work with the city manager's office on that. One program that I did want to mention, and it goes again to the West Mesa CDC collaboration, by moving the $100,000 over to the city code program, sort of the vision that I have is we do more work on a voluntary basis with neighborhoods. Currently, you know, we deal with one resident at a time. And when I drive around, particularly West Mesa, it doesn't really seem like we're making that much difference. What we've talked about is being able to collaborate with solid waste, with neighborhood outreach, with the housing and community development groups to actually work with the nonprofits, to work with the organized neighborhoods, to go into a neighborhood, a kind of a microcosm of the Building Strong neighborhoods, be able to work with solid waste to bring in dumpsters and get a whole block cleaned up. You know, when I drive around, there's just whole neighborhoods that really need some help. So we're hoping that collaborative work, we can leverage City of Mesa employees with the nonprofits and the organized neighborhoods using the solid waste dumpsters and that kind of thing to try to get those neighborhoods cleaned up.
Follow up? Yeah, just one. No, I appreciate the work that the West Mesa CDC does in this effort, but I really do think the city needs to be an active participant, and so that's why we need to add more code officers this fiscal year and then in coming fiscal years as well.
Okay.
So the interesting part, I've had a chance to meet with Mr. Brady just briefly, and we have all of these pressures from different departments, and we're at a point where we're watching the economy to see if it's going to grow and develop and see what opportunities we can go back and try and fill in some of the challenges, or does it take a turn and get worse? And so I know it's been an active topic and looking at some of the needs we need to. Mr. Brady, you have any feedback or what's your philosophy, how you want to?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we understand that this is something we've heard this discussion and some other items that council members have brought forward, but I think the discussion we had in February We recognized we were trying to hold the line because that's what it was going to take to balance the budget. At this point, you know, it's kind of a matter of decision points of do we wait and see in January and come back and revisit this with the idea of seeing if we're seeing any improvement in the sales tax economy, maybe even if we're seeing permit, you know, I say the activity's going up, I would suggest to you that activity's dropped off significantly in the development area since January. So we're hearing from the builders that things have, you know, slowed down. So we're being somewhat cautious of getting ahead of ourselves as far as how we would add additional positions or expenses. So that's our dilemma, is just trying to figure out how far do we extend ourselves beyond what our revenues that we're receiving today. So we can take, you know, the direction from the council. We, again, the philosophy has been with all the departments, and there's a lot of needs and demands, as try to hold the line with the existing resources we have. We've added some positions. We talked about school resource officers. We've identified $40,000 out of the service line warranty program to supplement code. That, of course, would be one-time dollars, but it could at least supplement some temporary services during the year. Full-time code officer is probably around $80,000 a year, I assume, fully loaded. So it's $160,000. So I don't, again, it's just a matter of how we want to get there. Do we want to wait and kind of see if the economy recovers, come back in January? Do we want to look at other resources? I'm trying to think of other resources. Are, you know, we know what sales tax is going to be. We know what state shared revenues is going to be. We have the transfer. We're already increasing that. I don't know if the council's appetite is to increase that anymore. But those are kind of the options we may would have to look at.
So maybe we can take this information and go forward, kind of look at some options and see where we're at. And realize, you know, the sensitivity, other departments, you know, have concerns. Police department heard a lot about through there, and just try and weigh it all and come up with a plan.
Right. And so, and I guess, and the code is absolutely a priority. I think we recognize that, and we'd like to do more. And we've got, you know, one of our top priorities that we'll be bringing the council as soon as this budget's adopted is looking forward to is most of the employees in the enterprise and general fund have not seen any pay increases in a significant amount of time. Many of them have been topped out. So at some point soon, we need to address that also. I think this is important. I agree. I'm kind of in this dilemma of which is the best approach to make this happen, I guess.
Okay. So look forward to getting some feedback as we go down there. Ms. Alonka, some more here? Or
okay. Real quickly.
Sure.
One of the programs that I really would like to emphasize is the collaborative programs we do with other departments, and particularly when we have unsafe structures. And I think this goes directly to the comment you just held or just heard. We do a lot of work when we have unsafe structures. Oftentimes those are identified through the police department where there's increased calls for activity, drug abuse, that kinds of thing. Squatters, quite frankly, that we found in some of the vacant houses. And when they get to the point where our building official can actually declare them unsafe, that's one of the other, I think, very important efforts that we work, again, very collaboratively with the Housing and Community Development group on what can we use CDBG money on, where can we find general fund money, because oftentimes getting those dilapidated, unsafe houses out of a neighborhood and just getting it scraped down to bare land makes a huge difference. And those are very time-consuming cases. It takes a lot of time on the part of the building inspectors. We rely on the good graces of our police department partners and the fire department to actually get those types of structures down, and it seems like we're seeing a lot more of those than we did several years ago. So that's just one other area. It takes a long time to get them down. I know, Councilmember Finter, we had one in particular that you were very frustrated about, but we continue to work with our partner departments when those kinds of things come up. Obviously, there's legal issues, making sure we have the owner's approval.
And we always talk about if you need legislative tools, as we contribute, because with our very limited resources, if we spend a lot of time running through some lengthy processes, maybe we ought to look at those. And I know we've had that discussion, so yeah. Always look for those opportunities.
Okay, and obviously we will continue to work on that and have more discussions. Wanted to move on quickly to our environmental and sustainability group. One of probably our most popular programs that group runs is the Household Hazardous Waste Program. In my tenure with the city, I have seen a significant decrease in the amount of illegal dumping because of the household hazardous waste events. It gives people a legal way to get rid of their hazardous materials. Over the last 5 years, we've collected over 226,000 gallons of waste, and we've serviced over 25 cars. And I just really wanted to give kind of a shout out to the environmental group. They are constantly changing the way they do business. We do 4 events a year. We've gone from 1 line to 2 lines to 3 lines. The average time that it takes to offload a car and get them out of there is 3 seconds. I mean, it really is pretty amazing. Every once in a while, we're slammed because we never know. But we hold 2 events on the east side over at the East Mesa Sewer Service Center, and we hold 2 events at the North Center Street area. So we try to split it up between the city to make it as easy as possible for residents. But that's been a very successful program. The other thing that Environmental and Sustainability has done, they do a tremendous amount of work on trying to get grants to leverage our resources. They get grants pretty regularly from the Bureau of Reclamation on grass to xeriscape programs. This is a commercial property that had turf in there, obviously high water usage, worked with our department and converted to a xeriscape product or landscaping, which is a huge water saving, and quite frankly, one could think it looks a whole lot better. One of the other things that we're doing actually with city buildings, there's been a really strong focus on increasing the energy efficiencies of city buildings because obviously that saves the city money. We're currently doing a couple of programs at the convention center and other city buildings where we're looking at low flow restroom facilities, saves a lot of water, primarily looking at HVAC systems and insulation, low-E windows, you know, the kind of thing that everybody is looking at in their own house, but ends up saving a huge amount of money. And we've actually worked with our facilities department in automating the controls on those buildings, because if I'm sitting in one office and I'm hot and Pam's sitting in her office and it's cold, it really decreases the efficiency of the building operation. So that's a major program that we're continuing to work with engineering and facilities on. So that pretty much takes care of that next slide there. Lighting is another one. I think we probably all heard about how much the old lighting fixtures cost versus the newer lighting fixtures. Those continue to increase in both the quality of the light and the efficiency. So we're relamping city buildings as much as we can. Another thing that you've heard a lot about are the solar installations. We've done most of that with rebate money from SRP. Most of the SRP rebates have gone away, but we're going to continue to look for other avenues to do that. One of the most exciting certainly was over at the new Fiesta Police Station on the west side. We've got a pilot installation out at the CAP plant. We've recently completed installation at the Multi-Gen Center, and we're working on a solar installation for covered parking at the East Mesa Library. So we're very excited about those programs. Obviously, residents and anybody uses those facilities love the covered parking. Plus, then we basically put the energy back into the grid and decrease the costs on the buildings. So I know that was a lot of information and probably more than you actually wanted. But if you have any questions.
Any questions, council members? No? Hey, thank you for we want you to take back, too, for all your professional staff. Let them know we appreciate the long hours. The stresses they go through, a lot of the accomplishments, Apples and others, have been directly linked to the hard work that goes on there. So we appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Our next item is to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on home funding allocations and priorities for projects requesting city participation in their applications for the Arizona Department of Housing's Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Basically, we have received four requests for participation in funding for four projects that are applying for Arizona Department of Housing's low-income tax credit projects. They're requesting home funds for gap financing or for certain points in certain categories. A couple weeks ago, you approved a substantial amendment that allowed us to take all of our prior year funding and put it in the rental housing program. On Monday night is a resolution for 14-15 funding to also go into the rental pool. Those combined funds would equal about a little more than $1.4 million. The requests we've received in your packet, I have a couple things for you. There's a spreadsheet that outlines all the four projects with some kind of high level, you know, what target population are they looking at, how many units are they providing, those type of things, as well as a tool that the Housing and Community Development Board used to make a recommendation to you on. Basically, we have a little over $1.5 million in requests. So the Housing and Community Development Board recommends to Council that all four are worthy of funding. Any combination of any three, we have enough funds to fund their requested amounts. The problem would lie in if all four received the low-income tax credit projects. We would be shy about 90,000. I'm going to go through the projects real quick. We have Sycamore Station, which is located over by the light rail Sycamore Station, just east of Dobson on Main Street. Here's just a quick elevation, and I know they have been working with planning, and this has changed slightly, but here's the colored one we had for the picture. They are basically targeting families between 40 and 60, area medium income. It's about an $18 million project. They are requesting $365,800 in a loan. There's 81 or 82 units that they will be applying. If the board recommends that they would receive full funding, provided there was only three projects, but should all four, they are recommending that this project would be reduced $30,303 for funding of $335,497. The next project is El Rancho 2, which is located about the 600 block of East Main Street. And here's an elevation again. They are completed with their work with planning as well. They are targeting the same family population, families between 40 and 60. This one is a demolition and new construction. So they are actually tearing down some old dilapidated buildings and reconstructing the new facility. They are projecting about a $15 million project, and they are requesting $300,000. Again, we should have the funds if we only have three projects, but if four, the board recommended $269,000, basically a $30,000 cut in this one as well. Then we have Encore on West First. That is the second phase of the senior facility right over here on First. They're elevations are similar to what they have there and have worked with planning. They are targeting a senior population, 55 plus, same area medium income of between 40 and 60,000. They're estimating about a little more than an $8 million constructor cost, and they are requesting $750,000 in loan. So for 44 units. And again, this is one of the projects that should all four be funded, the board recommended would take a $30,000 cut. The last one is La Mesita Phase 3. And their elevations are similar to what they've been building out there in Phase 1. This is the only one that is in a different category. They are applying for permanent supportive housing, and their target population is chronic homeless. It's about 30 units. And they are estimating a value of about almost $8 million, and they are requesting $125,000. The board recommended full funding on this one, no matter how many, if all four were approved. They would recommend that La Mesita receive the fully requested funding. The other three would take the $30,000 hit. Again, should all four be approved for tax credits. So their recommendation to you is that to fund any project that does receive the tax credits and that option if all four. But what we're looking for today from you is in that substantial amendment that you approved the other day, the final decision making for the funding came back to City Council. So we need to have that recommendation or vote from you so that we can move forward on who all would receive the funding.
Thank you. Mr. Richens.
I'm starting to get a little worried about market absorption for these projects. We've done several over the last few years, and we've even re-syndicated some that have flown under the radar. They haven't been the high-profile transformer projects, but Palm Cove re-syndicated some tax credits. They're in the same market with these. The senior housing I'm not as concerned with. I know Mayor Smith will be relieved to know that they've lowered the age to 55 so he can qualify now. As a candidate, I don't think he's making a ton of money. So I had to make a pot shot. He's gone now. So yeah, I didn't want to say that. You make too much money. So the senior one I'm not as concerned with. The phase twos, those other two projects, the one that I'm really concerned about is Sycamore Station. It's the right project with the wrong financing mechanism. And I think Sycamore Station, I like how it's designed. I like, you know, there are a few design issues like putting the pool up against the, where everybody's walking around for the transit station. It's kind of an awkward placement. But I do think, like, the design is generally the right project that we want there. But the financing is going to limit the market tremendously. And when you have Palm Cove less than a mile down the street, that is going to absorb a lot of those types of that same target population. I really think that we miss an opportunity. The other limitation with low-income housing tax credit is you can't do student housing. And so students would have a very difficult time moving into this project. And because of its situation on the Sycamore Station, I think it's perfectly placed to capture student population between ASU and some of our downtown universities. So, you know, I don't know that I can come to another conclusion than I can't support the Sycamore Station project. I support its design. I think it's the right project in the right place. But that financing mechanism is going to cause us real problems from a market standpoint. And so I think we need to be very cautious about supporting that project at this time. I fully support funding the other three.
Okay. Other thoughts? And so, yes, Mr. Cavanaugh.
Yeah, I appreciate Councilmember Richens' comments. He alerted me to this issue, which I was not aware of previously. I guess part-time students could live in this in the Sycamore Station project, but not full-time, according to the federal guidelines. And again, presumably with this being geared towards families, there could be, I'm hoping there will be the opportunity for students there. It's a very good project that the city's been working with for several years now. And in terms of our advisory board, it did receive a high ranking in terms of the four projects. So I'm still supportive of it. I'm disappointed in the restriction, federal restriction that indicates that this kind of housing is not available to people who are full-time students. But you'd confirm that, I think, for me as well. It seems to work at cross purposes in terms of a community's needs. Thank you.
Okay. So give us, if you could help me a little bit on the timeline, how quickly do we have to evaluate this and give you a motion with an approval? Are we up against a timeline here?
No. We will probably not know until about June whether which projects receive the tax credits, but we try to get in front of you as quickly as possible because this helps them shore up their financing. If they know that they are going to have an award from the city of a certain amount, that helps their investors feel more secure about the project, etc. At this point, the board, to be honest, the odds of all four of these projects receiving tax credits, given how many applied, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's not highly likely.
Okay.
So the chances are there will probably only be a few that actually receive the tax credits. And then, so the board recommended that any who receive tax credits that we would support with funding. Now, that doesn't keep the city from working with somebody on a normal apartment complex with home money to secure some home units in a market rate facility. We just would have to go out for an RFP after we determined how much money we really had left.
So for me, maybe we can find a consensus that the ones that we're okay with, and now that these concerns have been raised, I have some, and I haven't been briefed on this, and with all the other things going on, I'd like to get a little more information. But I think I can follow with the concerns that have been expressed from Councilmember Richens and Kavanaugh. If we can set that one aside, do we have consensus on the other three?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we have that consensus, I would say that we make that motion, or someone could make a motion.
Yeah, I would move to support those other three with full funding.
Okay.
And if anything gets a haircut, it's that project.
Okay.
You know, when it comes, you know, let the other ones get the funding they need to get. Oh, sorry. Let the other ones get the funding they need to get off the ground and have their full letter support. But that other one just and I don't know if that's over. You know, and maybe the solution is maybe some of the home funds go towards a market rate project to get a few affordable units in there, instead of restricting the entire project. And I know they have one unit that is market rate unit. Presumably that's for their manager to be in, is typically how that works. And so, you know, that would be a much better compromise, would be to get a few affordable units in there at the station site and then have the rest of the project to market rate. And I think I could work towards that. But the low-income housing tax credit financing that would restrict that whole project for multiple years is just, I'm really struggling with that. It's particularly, I mean, we have La Mesita less than a mile one way, and then you go into Tempe, there's some tax credit projects there, and then you go, and Palm Cove is a huge project that has a lot of affordable units. And that this dynamic, we're really starting to set up a dangerous dynamic of having an oversaturation of affordable units that the market can't absorb, and then you're going to have some struggling apartment complex competing in that space as well. I think we're too much in one segment of the market.
So if you could tighten up that motion a little bit, so we'll get a second.
Sorry, I made another speech.
Oh, that's fine.
Support the three fully funded, and then let's table the Sycamore Station recommendation until further investigation.
We have a good motion. We have a motion by Mr. Richens, a second by Councilmember Glover. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Mr. Kavanaugh, what do you think?
Nay.
We have so we would have four ayes and one nay, and we'll proceed. Do you have your direction then?
Thank you.
That motion tight? Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Get to our next item. Again, we have a very full agenda, so we're hustling along here. Okay. Hear a presentation and discuss a major general plan amendment for the property located north of McDowell and east of Higley Road. Mr. Wesley.
Mayor and Council, good morning. Here to do the first two presentations with regard to major general plan amendments that were received this year. First, I want to talk briefly about the schedule, the process, and what we're looking for this morning before we look specifically at the request. As you recall, on the major amendments, they're basically a year-long process. We require all these that are going to be submitted in a calendar year to come in at the same time. They'll ultimately all be heard by council at the same time. In the meantime, we'll be working with the public, doing a staff evaluation, going through a 60-day review process, and P&Z board will be required to hold two public hearings before this eventually comes back to you, potentially in October or maybe November of this year. So we're still in the early phase where the applicant have made their basically preliminary proposal for what they want to do with their major amendment. They will be filing a follow-up submittal in early May. And so they're getting some of that input and feedback on what they're proposing before they make that final submittal, because once that comes in, they really can't make any changes to the proposal. So we're here before you this morning to inform you of what this proposal is, so you can provide staff and the applicant with your thoughts and ideas about the pros and cons of this particular development, so they can use that to potentially modify their proposal before it comes back in. So this particular proposal we're looking at this morning is what we call the Longbow proposal. It's on the north side of McDowell between Higley and Recker Roads. It includes the Longbow golf course area, 305 acres. Currently, most of this area is designated as business park, with a piece north of Longbow Parkway up to the freeway as a community commercial. The business park designation is primarily a low-impact industrial type of development, allows some industrial and office-type uses, some commercial uses. It's an employment-type area. And the community commercial area is primarily a retail area that could develop along that north side. The proposal is to take that entire area and have the plan designation change to mixed-use residential. Mixed-use residential, again, is primarily an employment designation, but does allow up to 30% of the property to be used for residential uses at a minimum of 15 units per acre. The goal is to try to get that integrated employment, commercial, residential type environment in this type of district. Because we're in the Falcon Field area, any change from an employment designation to a residential use makes it a major amendment.
Question for you, Mr. Luna.
Mr. Wesley, what kind of residential units are we talking about? Are we talking about single-family homes? Are we talking about apartments? Can you describe that?
Sure. Yes. Again, the mixed-use residential requires it to be done at a minimum 15 units per acre. So when you're in that density range, you could potentially be doing some attached single-family products and townhome type thing, but most likely you're into an apartment complex type development. But no detached single-family would fit within that type of category.
Mr. Kavanaugh?
Thank you. Just at first blush and looking at the project, I have to admit I have some very major reservations over the change. I suspect that Falcon Field may have reservations. I suspect that our Economic Development Advisory Board may have concerns. I expect that our Economic Development staff will have concerns over moving residential into the business park here. And so I know we're, well, long way away from the stage where we vote on it, but I want to just send a signal, at least from my perspective, that I think this is something that council needs to look very long and hard at and seek advice from our Economic Development Advisory Board and staff, as well as Falcon Field, concerning the merits of the proposal. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr.
I also want to echo concerns relative to changing the rezoning. I just am not supportive of putting residential housing there. I certainly have to deal with the Falcon Field concerns, and I just don't think it's an appropriate use. So I would certainly be reluctant to support any change of the zoning.
Did you have some more information you wanted
to wrap up? Just a couple of real quick slides. Again, the application project narrative you have a copy of includes this graphic that shows the current projected number of jobs and what they would anticipate that to be under the change. They anticipate being able to maintain the same level of jobs plus add some of the housing units into the property.
Mr. Richens.
Yeah, this is where my question is how do we maintain the same number of jobs in a residential environment? Perhaps there could be somebody here that could help us clarify that.
Certainly, Mayor, Councilmember Richens, that's a question we have too. It's early in the process. We're just reporting what they've gotten to this point. We haven't done any analysis, but that would be part of the analysis we would do as we work on this over the next several months. Numbers are for that.
Yeah, it just didn't make any.
Well, not. We can discuss the number of jobs. I think what would concern from an economic development standpoint is what kind of jobs are they. You know, it's different when you can count jobs that are part of a mixed-use development that are maybe service-related jobs of, you know, providing to residents. But then there's the facility, if you're having more of a light industrial warehousing or in technical buildings where they're an actual building of employment, that's a very different kind of job than someone's who's in a professional services like dentist or doctors. So it's a different type of, I think, from the mix that we're talking about here that's mixed in with residential versus something that's part of a business park or industrial park too.
Right, and I think the other thing that's concerned is the impact to airport operations really worries me because, I mean, I get weekly emails from people, I'm not even in that district, I get weekly emails from people complaining about airport noise at Falcon Field, and there's a move afoot trying to shut Falcon Field down, and I there's no way I'm supporting that effort whatsoever. I just want to make that perfectly clear. You know, I knew that Sky Harbor Air, I'm on the final approach for Sky Harbor. I knew the airport was there when I moved in. You know, I did my due diligence. I knew that all existed. And so it's just shocking to me that an airport can be somewhere for 70 years and then people move into that area. And if I put more rooftops there, it just exacerbates that issue. And I just like, I'm having a hard time. And when you look at the way it's configured, it is at the end of the runway. That is not the most quiet section of the takeoff process. So it just, I'm having a really hard time with this one.
Yes, please.
It's funny that you say that. I had an opportunity to fly with the Warbirds during the Falcon Field open house. And so as we're flying and it banks over to the right, it's right over that property. It's just not a good place for residential homes.
And so, Mayor, with that, we'll point out that the Falcon Field subarea plan also designates this area for the business park employment-type uses, and the draft of the new general plan continues that theme of employment for this particular area.
Very good.
P&Z Board looked at this last night. They had similar concerns.
Okay, they had some concerns, waiting to hear back from there. Well, as you can tell, a lot of strong feelings. The great thing is Falcon Field has $2.3 billion of impact in this community, a Boeing, MD helicopters, others. We have a lot of exciting things going on out there. And then we have some of these challenges. You know, with the economy coming back, there's always been this pressure over history to put residential rooftops in some of our more commercial and economic development type areas. And so I've had a chance to meet with Councilmember Luna. He's been right on top of this and looking at the concerns. This is a great opportunity to be able to put together a group or a task force, stakeholders, and try and look at these issues holistically. We need to look at these land use issues, infrastructure, aviation concerns, and all the positives that are going there, and where are we going in the future. So I've been talking with the city manager, Mr. Luna, others, and hopefully in the next week or so, we're going to be able to roll out this group effort that starts immediately to look at all of these different issues. We actually need to take this bull by the horns and get it going in the right direction. A lot of good things are happening, but we need to make sure that it's for the growth and betterment of that entire area. And so I think you'll hear in the next couple of days as we work with Mr. Brady to see and would welcome input from the other council members of who should be on this board and then proceed forward and then come back in a rapid manner with some recommendations of how to deal with what's and really get a strategic vision of what's going on in that area instead of being reactionary to this item or that item or aviation or something. So looking forward to being able to do that. I definitely have huge concerns about a residential product off that end of the runway. And I do think we need to work with the applicant to come up with a better plan, a better idea. But if we're giving notice now, and I think you're hearing it from others, very concerned, and I just don't want them to go all the way down this road and then suddenly realize that there isn't the support there. Was there any other comments that wanted to be added to that? Okay. Well, I think you have that information.
Thank you
for taking the time to turn it in. Okay. Next item is discuss the election of the office of mayor, the appointment of the vice mayor, and provide direction regarding whether to fill District 2 council seat and the selection process for that position. I'm just going to give us a little overview. Ms. Spinner, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Finter, members of the council. With Mayor Smith leaving office yesterday, it leaves a vacancy in the office, and we have a new mayor. So I thought I would take a minute and just explain how we will go about filling all the different positions. Because there's more than 2 years left in Mayor Smith's term, our charter now requires, we had a charter change in 2012, the charter now requires that the position be filled by the election. So what you see on your agenda for Monday night, the resolution calling the election includes filling the position of the office of mayor along with the three council district positions that are being held. So that election date is August 26th. If we have a successor at that point, so we have a winner, and we don't require a runoff, that individual will be sworn in as mayor as soon as the election is canvassed and we have the results. Okay, so probably be mid-September is what the expectation is. Our charter also says that for candidates who wish to run for mayor, because we have a vacancy, we now have 10 days for any candidate to declare themselves a candidate for mayor and to file a statement of organization with the city clerk's office. So the mayor left yesterday, April 16th. 10 days would be a Saturday, so it will be, the deadline will be Monday, April 28th, close of business, 6 o'clock. By that point, anyone wishing to run for mayor must have declared themselves a candidate and file a statement of organization with the city clerk's office. And their nomination petitions will be required by May 28th, and they'll require 1,000 signatures to be eligible to run for mayor. Okay, so do we have any questions about the filling the office of mayor?
No.
Okay, the next issue is we now don't have a vice mayor since Vice Mayor Finter has ascended to the mayor's position. Our charter says that the council has 30 days to elect a new vice mayor. So that will be by May 16th. The council will be asked to fill the position of vice mayor. Okay. Any questions on that issue?
No questions.
The next issue is District 2 council seat. The charter actually gives the council the option. You may choose to fill the position. The expectation is that we're going to have a new mayor at some point, and Mayor Finter, if he chooses, will resume his position as District 2 council. So you can fill the position from now till the new mayor is sworn in, if that's your choice. So that would be issue number one for today. Does the council want to go ahead and fill the position? You have 30 days from the day the office of mayor became vacant. So again, you would have the latest day would be May 16th to fill that position. But if you're ready to move forward today, if council chose to do that, we've actually agendized so you can go into executive session and discuss how you might want to do that and what the selection process would look like.
Wonderful. Feedback from the council members. What would you like to do? Do we have any on backfilling?
Do you want to move into executive session?
Well, first I think they would tell us if we make this decision to backfill the position, then we'll go into an e-session talk about
that. That's right.
If that's the preference to backfill, then right. We go to the executive session, talk about the process.
Right. Mr. Richens.
Yeah, I would say that. Go ahead and backfill.
Backfill?
I agree.
Okay. Yeah, so we're all in agreement to go ahead and backfill the position. So I'd like to take a motion. We had to move into an executive session by Mr. Glover, seconded by Mr. Luna. And we'll also be discussing at that time an issue on 6300 East Main.
That's correct, Mayor.
So it may take us a few minutes, and then we plan to come back out here and have some further discussion in public. Thank you. We are adjourned to that meeting. Okay, we're going to reconvene our study session. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor, members of council. From the direction received from the council, is proposed for the temporary filling of the District 2 council position. What we're announcing today, and we'll be putting this out on our website and a press release today, is that we'll be receiving all applications through the city's webpage for those interested in filling the position. And the deadline for receiving those applications will be by the end of business, which will be 6 o'clock, on Monday, April 21st. So those applications are due by the end of the day on the 21st. Then we will have posted on the, we'll have a special council meeting for the April 24th, which will have the opportunity for the council then to nominate an individual from those applications to fill a position on the 24th. The expectation of the council is that that decision by the council will be made that morning, the 24th, a week from today, and then immediately the individual that is selected by the council will be sworn in and will participate with the council immediately following that on the 24th.
And then the next regularly scheduled council meeting,
we do the ceremonial swearing in, which would be May 5th. So And the location for that application will be on the mayor and council webpage under mesa.gov. You'll be able to find that application.
Okay. And then if we could, thank you for that information. That's the District 2 council member process. And then if we could add on to Monday's agenda the election of the vice mayor, if we could put that in there.
Okay.
We'll get that done in a rapid manner. Okay.
I'll add that. Thank you.
So let's quickly move to the remaining items. Here are reports on meetings and conferences attended. We've had a long day, probably going to pass it unless you have some. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. Acknowledge the receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. We have a motion by Mr. Luna, second by Mr. Richens. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we'll move past that portion. Now, reports, meetings attended, conferences, anybody? Wonderful. Mr. Brady, scheduling of meetings.
Just a quick reminder, our next study session council meeting will be Monday, April 21st. And this Saturday, April 19th, from 11 to 5 p.m. at the Mesa Amphitheater will be Wingstock or music and chicken meat. We encourage everyone to attend. There's also an Easter egg hunt for kids, so they can come early for that at 10:30 a.m. So we're looking forward to that. Tickets are on sale at themesaamp.com. And also just looking forward to the following Saturday, we'll have a Celebrate Mesa free event at Pioneer Park from 2 to 6 p.m. First, oh, go ahead, Mel. I don't have that. Is that tonight?
No, it's actually the 23rd of next week.
Oh, sorry.
First Generation is a presentation on four individuals that gone through the process of trying to navigate through the financial aid process and to determine their and working towards a success in college. And so we will be showing a documentary on April 23rd at the Piper Theater, starting at 5:30. We will be having some college representatives as well as some assistance with financial aid, so help any parents or any kids interested in going to college to learn about how you go through that process. So I would encourage the community to attend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brady, any other items?
That's it.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a motion for adjournment? We have a motion, second. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned.